from WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
A toda mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, April 25th, 2025. We're also here on LatinoMediaCollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the future of history following the Trump administration's assault on museums, art, literature, the language used to discuss history, and how it all affects people of color here in the U.S. And so we have the honor and the pleasure today of having back on the show James Early, who's a former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. It's been a while, James Early, but welcome back to the show.
I'm pleased to come back, particularly at this crisis moment.
Absolutely. And I should point out right off the bat that the last time we had you on the show, it was 1 week after the events of the January 6th insurrection in 2021. And so in my opinion, and I don't know if you have the same opinion as well, but the assault on history and education and any other forms of it by this current administration, for me at least, feels like an extension of what we saw on January 6th of 2021, almost 4 years ago. So obviously this second incarnation of the Trump administration is pulling us from one crisis to another with almost little opportunity to keep up with all of it. Trump's assault on history, particularly the administration's assault on the Smithsonian, certainly hits close to the work you have done during your time when you were at the Smithsonian. The most obvious example of this is the March 27th executive order entitled, quote unquote here, "Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History," end quote. It specifically targeted African-American history, women's history, and in the process made backhanded comments on the LGBTQ rights as well. It even targeted the National Zoo and the country's national parks. So There's a question there, and it's hard to frame it because, again, it's hard to keep up with all these crises happening all at once. But are we beyond the pretense of what comes across at first glance as revisionist history here? And should we just call this a general whitewashing of history? We could go in all sorts of directions as to how to prove that, but the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. This is a critical moment of the spread of an authoritarian government, really towards a dictatorship of capitalists. They are actually engaged with the MAGA Trump administration in concentrating their power to be greedy and to exploit as much as they can. I think we have to start with the framework that they have been very bluntly clear about over the march of time with the rise of Trump, who is an expression of a social movement called MAGA, Make America Again. I don't think we should conflate the two. The Tea Party was an early iteration of what we see MAGA today, and MAGA today has taken over much of state governance across the country. And of course, what Trump has added to that, as Steve Bannon, one of the major strategists this movement has laid out, is a dismantling of the administrative state. So they are taking a systemic approach, and they're well on their way to dismantling the liberal democratic administrative state and reinstitutionalizing that in an authoritarian government, with Trump already talking about running for a third term. And while he is an extraordinary, vulgar, and megalomaniac personality, he is being supported by a large voter base. And that's what we have to see, that kind of framework. And so the attacks on libraries, museums, the Institute for Museum Services, the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, of the dismantling of the Federal Education Department, is a battle of ideas. It is to reinstitute really a white male supremacy, Eurocentric vantage point to socialize the nation, and that those who don't fit that sociological and ethnic background are at best secondary citizens. They're very, very clear about this. So that the attack on the Smithsonian Institution, where I worked for 32 years in various positions, the frontal attack is on the African American Museum. This is another example of the consistent racialized nature that has been since the founding of this republic, and rationalizing the enslavement, the super exploitation, the super dehumanization, and a rationale that the Bible set a context for this, and other kinds of rationales in which then blackness really becomes a fundamental reflection of the exploitative nature of the society. We have to remember in 68, the Centric Studies Movement in San Francisco, the Black Studies Movement, the Latino Studies Movement, blackness again was a catalyzing process. It opened the new iteration of the women's movement. It informed the LGBTQ movement. What do I mean by the fact that it catalyzed and informed? These were legal cases raised by Black Americans that then opened a new framework of democracy that other groups looked into that mirror and said, me too, we are lacking too. And so that those legal precedents set the framework for an expansion of democracy with other social groups, ethnic, racial, gender, sexual identities. Thinking back to Reconstruction, the movement for mass education comes out of descendants of enslaved Africans pushing for their access to education, which then opens education for the masses of people. So that this frontal attack on the National African American Museum for History and Culture at the Smithsonian Institution is a horizontal attack on women, Latinos. It will be on the climate. In order to really change the American mind, we've seen the censorship in libraries, gutting libraries of all aspects of history and gender studies and the like, and all democratic movements that don't fit the stereotype of a Eurocentric white supremacist and predominantly male. Now, one might ask the question, where does Marco Rubio come in? Or where do these Black Republicans come in? we all have free will. They are not alienated from some authentic, centralized, primordial culture. They have made independent decisions, as was done in the period of slavery on the continent of Africa, as is done with the right wing and various elements of Latin America. So there is nothing essentially virtuous because we are Black or we are women or we are Latino. And so that we are in a new era. And so this is a struggle to really socialize the American mind back into a segregated society. And I think we have to see it that way, that this is moving very rapidly. It's expanding very widely. And this sort of superstructural approach, one might call it that, of ideas, taste, philosophy, outlook, is the top dimension of the economic stranglehold. And where they're taking over the economy and giving money to the oligarchs and putting oligarchs really into governance, so that we have to see the economics and the cultural dimension as two sides of the same coin. And that's what this attack, I would say, is generally about. And we can speak more specifically about the order of the Smithsonian and how that might be confronted.
So to prove your point, I have a copy of the executive order from the White House in front of me. And you're right, they specifically target the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And they said it here directly, quote, "The National Museum of African American History and Culture has proclaimed that hard work, individualism, and the nuclear family are aspects of white culture." And they mention all those things in quotations. They also criticize the Smithsonian American Art Museum with regards to a feature called The Shape of Power, Stories of Race in American Sculpture, an exhibit representing, and this is their quote here, "Societies, including the United States, have used race to establish and maintain systems of power, privilege, and disenfranchisement. The exhibit further claims that sculpture has been a powerful tool in promoting scientific racism and promotes the view that race is not a biological reality, but a social construct, stating race is a human invention." These are the things that the executive order from this administration is criticizing. And one can agree or one can disagree. But the position here by this administration is no, not even talk about it at all whatsoever, which is what you just mentioned. Now, turning our attention to the Kennedy Center, Donald Trump, the individual, gutted the Kennedy Center Board of Trustees and appointed himself the chairman earlier this year. This led to, among other things, several artists and musicians canceling their performances in protest. It also fired Vice President and Artistic Director Mark Bamuthi Joseph. Here's a clip that Joseph took from his office following his termination. So let's take a listen.
Well, I am sitting in my office at the Kennedy Center one last time. It's funny, I'm taking things down, like this red, black, and green American flag and this extraordinary piece of artwork that my man Greg made that honors Stevie Wonder, and this poster from BAM, and a commemorative album that was organized by Swiss Beats. Basically, I'm taking down everything Black in my office, just as the new leadership of the Kennedy Center is doing its best to disavow much of the literal color that has made this place special. I'm grieving and angry and also ready to be rid of the moral injury that has come with being in this place. It's hard to say goodbye, but it isn't hard to say goodbye to an oppressive situation. So may liberation be my liturgy. I'm proud of what we made here. We will always have an impact.
So again, that was Mark Bamuthi Joseph recording a video in his office following his firing from the Kennedy Center. What are your thoughts on these series of events at the Kennedy Center? Just to name a few.
Well, for a number of years, when Robert McCormick Adams was Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, I was the Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. He called me to his office one day and he said, I'd like for you to represent me on the board of the Kennedy Center. So I represented the Smithsonian on the board of the Kennedy Center. One, the Kennedy Center's funding comes through the same legislation. It's attached to the Smithsonian Institution in a kind of peculiar way. And one of the first things and most consistent thing I did on that board representing the Smithsonian at large was to raise the question of diversity. Diversity at the level of curatorial and administrative employment, because that sets the basis for what kinds of aesthetics will be included, what kinds of art and performances will be included. So this is part and parcel of the same attack on the Smithsonian of the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion attack, which has been a democratic advance for people of color, including women, including upper-class white women who got the biggest bounce off of affirmative action, because when they looked into the mirror of discrimination, it was reflected, you know, to be a white woman, even of a middle and upper class, you're making less of a dollar than with the same equal education. And then you add race, gender, sexual identity, the super exploitation and discrimination and dehumanization attacks increases in that context. So the attack on the Smithsonian is part and parcel, again, of this systemic, this overall attempt to re-socialize America. What Donald Trump and the MAGA movement have done in the second iteration of Trump is Trump MAGAism, because when Trump is no longer here, it does not mean that MAGA will have disappeared. We have to understand that. We have to be careful on the personification of politics, as dangerous of a megalomaniac as he is. Even the right wing is not always consistently supportive because he's not dependable. So he's a kind of jack out of the box. But this is bigger than Donald Trump. So that this attack on the Kennedy Center has its organized expression also extending into Hollywood. Trump has brought some of the most renowned anti-Semites and racist and male misogynist as his liaisons to Hollywood. So he's attacking the whole cultural, educational, art, aesthetic, philosophy, identity system that has developed over the course of the evolution of this republic and people struggling to get equality. They're now saying, no, we're going to erase that and go back to the initial settler colonialism in which white supremacy, Eurocentrism dominated the indigenous communities, enslaved these Africans, took over almost half the country, changed the flag and changed the border, but they could not change la cultura. And so we see the re-Hispanicization or the re-Latinamericanization of the country, in which right wingers who were going after English only, and there is an attempt to reinstitute English only, but they've had to deal with the reality that Spanish speaking Americans, I'm not just speaking of immigrants, I'm talking about multi-generational US citizens, continue to build their lateral connections to their great great grandparents, their grandparents, and with remittances going back into Latin America, keeping that social bond. And so this is an attack on all of that. That attack is extended in trying to recolonize the Panama Canal zone, threats against sending the military into Mexico, the concentration camps, Guantanamo being the most notable one. And we need to talk about the Democrats in this process as well, not just the Republicans and Trump. And now in El Salvador, this gulag, this new concentration camp,
yes,
this vulgar, vile, brutal dehumanization of people who have been accused of being members of MS-13. Many of them probably are, but it does not mean that we treat them like animals. Some of them are obviously not. That has been documented. So this is a systemic process. And again, the attack on the Smithsonian will go lateral. We must also then look at members of our own community. Just in the last 2 years, right-wing Cubans have attacked the Smithsonian, threatening to deauthorize the Latino Museum, saying that there was a Marxist exhibit. Of course, this was an exhibit of curators of Puerto Ricanos, Dominicanos, Mexicanos, todos estadounidenses, all from the United States, and they were accused of being Marxist. And the Smithsonian stepped back on that. We've not seen the Democratic Party step up. In fact, we've seen the Democratic Party intersect with a lot of this. So that the student protests, which is the right to speak, the freedom of speech, is also a part of this systemic attack on culture and to try to re-socialize people to follow one thought of what America is about. So that we have many Democrats who are in the pockets of the Israeli lobby, which is buying up the Warnocks of Georgia, the Cory Bookers of New Jersey, who are funding this genocide against Palestinians, the most concentrated expression of inhumanity on the globe today. Yes, there are other genocides going on, but this is a most concentrated one in which the most powerful nation in the world is funding apartheid Israel, occupation Israel, ethnic cleansing Israel, genocide Israel, and many Black Americans, including Jeffries, who heads the Democratic Party, are in the pocket of the Israeli AIPAC lobby. And so that see many Latinos. Marco Rubio is also involved in a lot of questionable issues. And so this is not a simple white, non-white issue, although it is essentially a white supremacist move. There are some people of color who, for very opportunistic reasons, are involved in executing this.
We are between a rock and a hard place with the overt fascism and whitewashing of history by this current Republican Party. And it's not just Donald Trump, the individual, but the entire Republican Party. And on the other side, we have passive acquiescence by many people in the Democratic Party side.
And active participation in the sense of the censorship, for example. So the Democratic Party leadership, and I think we need to separate the Democratic Party leadership from the Democratic Party base. When we say we're criticizing the Democratic Party, I think we have to be a bit more precise about this. It is the leadership of the Democratic Party, which is very factionalized and fractionalized, which are fighting against the social democracy, elected politicians by its base, and the one democratic socialist in the case of Bernie Sanders, and AOC, who was kicked out of the Democratic Socialist of America. I think it was a mistake on the part of the Democratic Socialist of America to split over that issue. But the Democratic Party is against Bernie Sanders. Remember that Clyburn, the African-American congressman, who was like third in the rank, or the fourth in the rank of the Democratic Party, when Bernie was running far ahead in the primary, said any Black woman will do, and selected Kamala Harris, who bought in fully in, refused to back away from any of the Biden positions around the slaughter in Israel. And so we have a contradiction in the leadership of the Democratic Party and a contradiction in the whole of the Republican Party that we must take on.
Yeah, I've had several guests on the show in the past year alone that have said things in much the same manner as well, to the same degree as how you describe it. Now, going back to the issue of history here, and you may have mentioned this indirectly already, that while it is unfair to separate Latino history and African-American history during this time as two separate things, we should point out that in the mid-2000s, there was a concerted effort by Republicans to ban ethnic Latino studies in the state of Arizona. The Latino Media Collective did a whole show on this earlier this year, which points out that this current attack on history is not exclusive to Donald Trump, the individual, and such things don't happen in a vacuum. The proposed Smithsonian National Museum of the American Latino is not off the ground yet, but is now in serious jeopardy because of this current Trump administration. So, James, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the last time we had you on the show, we spoke about the Monroe Doctrine the week after the January 6th insurrection. As fascist an action as it is to attack museums in this manner, does the history of the Monroe Doctrine at least explain this whitewashing of history as well? Because if all Americans understood the Monroe Doctrine, they would understand or have a better understanding at least of this whitewashing that we're seeing right now.
Well, certainly there's an intersection, if memory serves me correctly, I think 1832, the Monroe Doctrine, the late Sal Landau of the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, who did the first global interview with Fidel Castro along with Dr. Brenner from American University, posited a few decades ago the end of the Monroe Doctrine. And we had a conference just a few years ago, Medea Benjamin with Code Pink and others, about the end of the Monroe Doctrine. But the Monroe Doctrine is being revived. The MAGA and Trump administration with Rubio and others are making very, very clear that this is the United States sphere of influence. This is the United States backyard. And of course, they have some allies in this megalomaniac in El Salvador, who's a fascist, and Milei in Argentina, who's another authoritarian. Lula barely won with 2 million votes in Brazil. And although Bolsonaro hopefully will end up in jail because he is now under criminal review, it is very, very clear that the right wing is trying to move back, and there is an alliance. There's a global alliance. And Steve Bannon is very key to this. And so they're tied to this authoritarian in Hungary, the right wing in Germany. Bannon tried to buy a university in Rome to train people. And so that the Monroe Doctrine certainly is reemerging, and the Monroe Doctrine will carry forth the Eurocentric and white supremacist orientation, keeping in mind that the indices of poverty, disease, discrimination, imprisonment across Latin America is very colorized. Indigenous, Afro-descendants, Euro-Latino-Americans from the working class, LGBTQT, and so the same kind of cultural war, while they try to take over the natural resources, the largest reserve of oil in the world is in Venezuela. One of the major reserves of clear water is in Paraguay. Oil and gas in Brazil and Guyana. They're after all of that, and they will go after the people of color, indigenous people, single women with children, rural women, working class women will suffer the most. And so there is an intersection of the cultural profile that they are trying to revive of, quote unquote, make America again. It is back to European settler colonialism, in which at best non-Europeans are second class citizens. And of course, there will be the continued exploitation of the poor whites. The largest group of impoverished people in the United States are not Latino. They are not Black Americans. They are white Americans, but no one talks about that. And so that this is an untapped reserve in the war against racism, the war against fascism, the war against the working class, that I think we have to think about and that we should talk about before we conclude our interview. So where is the fight back? What needs to be taken? But we can come to that point later.
Absolutely. We just hit the tip of the iceberg, I guess. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with James Early. He's a former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Inner Circle, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the future of history with James Early, who's a former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. So as we mentioned in the first half of the show, considering that attack on ethnic studies in Arizona during the mid-2000s and the current attacks on the Smithsonian in an attempt to attack DEI, or however they want to phrase it, will the very existence of HBCUs also be called into question? We actually did a show here on the Latino Media Collective almost a year ago talking about the Republican Party, not Trump the individual, but the Republican Party's assault on HBCUs and their funding. And as we record this interview, there are questions about the future of federal funding for HBCUs. So if the current administration can bar the Associated Press from White House access for not referring to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, nothing is off the table here, including the future of HBCUs. Because again, this sort of ties to what we mentioned with regards to Arizona and ethnic studies. If this party in particular can create a movement that almost banned ethnic studies altogether in the state of Arizona, then the ambiguity of such a push can also call HBCUs into question.
Indeed, HBCUs are a part of the target of this administration. And I think we have to ask ourselves, what is motivating this? What is motivating this is the colorization of America. Latinos are the second largest cultural group in the United States. If we looked at the end of the century, people of color will be the majority in the society. And so there is a sense of threat against the prototype of the Eurocentric white male dominance and the emergence of white females trying to get equity with white males. And so the Arizona attack was just a drop in the bucket signaling where the future would be and what they're trying to take us back to. And so HBCUs will certainly come under attack. I'm really concerned about Howard University, which was set up for the descendants of enslaved Africans, which has a significant federal budget, and I think they will be targeted. Certainly, if they can target Harvard and Yale and these other institutions, yes, they will come after us. But I want to go back to the Smithsonian Institution for a moment and the attack on the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It is really important that we look at the specificity of these institutions that are being attacked. And while there is a common line of attack against inclusion about race and gender and sexual identity, the institutions vary, and therefore the counterattack, the resistance movement and the transformation movement coming from progressive citizens must examine what are the specificities of each. In the case of the Institute for Museum and Library Services, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, attacking DEI is easier because they are institutions that come under the vertical authority of the executive branch. The Smithsonian Institution is a peculiar institution. It is a unique institution in its juridical construction. It is called a public trust. So the head of the Smithsonian is not appointed and approved by the executive in the White House, be she or he Democrat or Republican. They have a separate board of regents, a policymaking group, on which the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, by way of tradition, not by way of juridical orientation, convenes that board of regents. The position of the vice president sits on that. And then there are three members of the House, three of the Senate, and several members, I forget the exact numbers now, from the general public. One must come from Washington, D.C. I think one or two must come from New York and California, which is a reflection of the history of the large populations of California and New York at the time that that was set. Those things may have changed since I was an assistant secretary going to those Board of Regents meetings. But there's going to be a fight back. It's always underway. African-American lawyers are convening for a potential class action suit. And I'm hoping that that suit will focus on this construct of the Smithsonian as a public trust. That means we, the public, at institutions is being held for us, as contrasted with the National Endowment for the Arts or the Humanities Institute for Museum Library Services, other cabinet kinds of posts. And this is where African-Americans have to assume a public role, as we historically have, a crucible, a test case. So the pushing for the advancement into democracy by enslaved Africans and descendant of enslaved Africans, there are many historical precedents, again, that open up pathways for other ethnic, racial, social class groups to also advance. And so we need to build that alliance and not just collapse these things that, oh, this is the same attack. The director of the National African American Museum at the Smithsonian Institution has left the institution in the last 3 or 4 months. A lot of people, Black Americans, rush to say, oh, this is because of Trump. No, that's quite a different thing. It had to do with his management. So we can't conflate that. Some African Americans refer to the National Museum of African American History at the Smithsonian as the Blacksonian. That's too narrow. What Lonnie Bunch, who is the secretary of the Smithsonian, he's the founding director of the African American Museum, he said, and this is the basic framework, African American history is American history. And these test cases, these legal cases show that the advance of democracy, the pluralism, the centric studies that came out of 68 out of San Francisco State, African Americans have played a critical role in opening that. Now, we also must be careful here. As the century moves on, when we look back at the end of the century, I will predict that the Latino Americanization of the United States, the re-Latin Americanization of the United States, will be the basic sociological cultural framework of opening up new avenues for democratic advance that African Americans and all other kinds of groups will be able to take advantage of. So this is not an essentialism about African Americans. It's just looking at the way that history has evolved and the way that there is an attempt to roll history back, which is what was done with Reconstruction, which was done by all of the laws, the racialized laws, the laws against Chinese, and so forth and so on. And in this context, Latinos and other groups, I think, can find proper alliances and find a common leadership to advance our common interests as the public for which the Smithsonian is being held in trust.
I'll take it a step further. Not only should we protect important institutions of education like the Smithsonian Institution, but in the process and along the way, we should probably decolonize the mind as well. Not to limit history, not to just set it onto one path or one term, but to expand upon it, expand to what we know and improve upon it and include all other groups that deserve our attention and deserve a spotlight in history, in American history, as you said. Now, among the horrendous things that have happened in the last two and a half years is obviously what has taken place in Gaza. We can't go through the whole history in just one program. But along the way, and this was earlier this year, the concept of scholasticide was brought up to describe the calculated destruction of the Palestinian educational institutions in the Gaza Strip. Earlier this year, the American Historical Association voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution condemning scholasticide in Gaza. Here in the U.S., people with legal residency have disappeared. I'm using that word, disappeared, and are set for deportation for protesting for Palestinian rights. Can we tie the issue of scholasticide with student protests that not only assault free speech, but how these moments can be documented in the future? It's a lofty question, but it's a question that is given to you because of the sense of urgency of the situation.
Indeed, we can tie them together, keeping in mind that this authoritarian, fascist, white supremacist, misogynist, homophobic movement in the United States expressed in MAGA and in its extreme expression through Trump is tied into Orban in Hungary, Bolsonaro in Brazil, the right wing in Germany and Italy and other places. And they all are anti-immigrant. They are all going after the people of color from the former colonies. So this is a global movement with multiple expressions. And so scholasticide, what we've seen happening in Gaza, which has been supported by a lot of the Democratic Party leadership, now the attacks on Harvard and these other major universities and the threats against HBCUs, that is all multiple expressions of the same scholasticide, if you will, for the purpose of pushing them to have one common framework, which is not about people struggling to become equal in the society, but it's about how great America is and be thankful that you're a part of it. That also includes right-wing Latinos. So on the Smithsonian Board of Regents now is a Miami-based, his name escapes me for the moment, right-wing congressperson who will be in cahoots with Vance, the vice president of the United States. That position sits on the policymaking body, the Board of Regents at the Smithsonian, who will attack the fundamental mandate of the Smithsonian, which is the increase and diffusion of knowledge. So this is, again, that scholasticized attempt to whiten that and to make America white supremacist again and say to us who are not of those ethnic and racial groups, be pleased that you're here and not in Africa. Be pleased that you're here and not in Guatemala, and so forth and so on.
It's infuriating, to say the least. Now, I want to address this, and I think this doesn't get the attention that it deserves. But on March 14th, the Trump administration called for the elimination of the Institute of Museum and Library Services, the nation's only federal agency for the country's libraries. And real quickly, in a statement, the American Library Association laid out a list of services they provide. This includes early literacy development and grade level reading programs, summer reading programs for kids, high-speed internet access, employment assistance for job seekers, braille and talking books for people with visual impairments, so on and so forth. I bring this up to you because while this may not receive the same headlines as the other topics that we discussed, can you tell us about the importance of these services outside big metropolitan areas like Washington, D.C.? Because you mentioned earlier that the majority of the poor in this country are white Americans, and they are not in Washington, D.C. And so we have to address that while we have the good fortune to be in a major metropolitan area, in the more rural areas of the country, this is going to be, if anything, counterproductive.
Well, what is the common thread of all these institutions? Libraries, museums, universities and colleges, mass media. It is information. It is education. It is access. Libraries are the freest institutions of access for learning that an individual citizen, resident, or immigrant, she or he can simply walk into the doors and ask about something that they're interested in, and on their own initiative, become learners, empower themselves to be able to read and understand the world such that they can more fully participate in informing which way the world will go, not just which way will the United States go. So this is the common thread, the Smithsonian Institution, the mandate, increase and diffusion of knowledge. Library books are being metaphorically burned. They're being erased, censored. Voices, the freedom of speech is being censored. And Donald Trump has made very clear, first they come after the immigrants and send them to Guantanamo and then send them to El Salvador. And next they're coming after the quote unquote homegrown people that they want to say who are terrorists. And my family has an extended family member who is not a bloodline member, 1,000% Jewish, Dr. Maura Finkelstein, the first professor, tenured professor. Her job was taken away because she is pro-Palestinian rights. She is anti-Zionist. And so she's being charged with anti-Semitism, although she is Jewish. This is the convolution that they are attempting with the resocialization by taking over these educational and information institutions and running one perspective about who is in America, what is America, what you should know, what you can say and what you can't say. This is the authoritarianism. And Democrats, in terms of the First Amendment, have bought right into that vis-a-vis protecting Zionism and the ethnic cleansing and genocide. And so these students who are going to jail, Democratic Party leadership has a major responsibility along with MAGA and Trump in this process. And so what are the implications for us? We just cannot fight as librarians or as ethnic studies teachers, as freedom of speech advocates, or as Palestinians, or as Jews for Progress. We have to have a horizontally integrated popular front movement uniting all who can be united against this march of white supremacy Christian fundamentalism, fascism, misogynism that is not coming. It's already here, and it's moving very, very quickly. So we have seen sector-specific responses, federal workers at the Labor Department, or federal workers at USAID. But we have to find an integration among those workers. And while we unite all who can be united, rather than just trying to do this as individual sectors, we have to also take care that we cannot go back to the way it was, because there is a Make America Again orientation of the Democratic Party leadership as well, which is to go back to the old duopoly competition between centrist Democrats and moderate Republicans, the John McCains, and although Cheney was never moderate. They want to go back to that, which did not serve us well either. And so this is a moment of mass radical perspective. When I say radical, I mean looking at the root of things and how we change the root of the system, which is not a revolution, but it is a new vantage point of how to advance democracy. It's not a reinstitution of the old liberal democracy, because the Democrats drug their feet. If you look at the Smithsonian Institution, I went there in 1984. My office with the late Ralph Renzo, who was then the assistant secretary, I was the deputy. We initiated the process of a multicultural grouping from the public coming into the Smithsonian. Out of that came the committee that set up Latino Focus, and out of that has emerged now to a museum focus. The gay and lesbian movement, which was not as advanced democratically as it is now, there were rumors and hush hush, because we were the Office of Diversity, they came to our office and we were able to work with them on healthcare issues against AIDS and to have museums recognize the high incidence of AIDS within the museum community and to be openly, as a democratic advance, take that on. The American Indian Museum, it was our office who invited the first director. We did not know, he was a lawyer. His father was a renowned American Indian artist. We did not know he had interest in museums, but he came through that process of our invitation because we were horizontally integrating ourselves. I was not just the Black assistant secretary. People would say, why are you talking to Latinos and so forth and so on? Asian Pacific Americans. We also opened up that committee because our orientation was the most that we knew were talking about Chinatowns. I mean, we were so ignorant of our common fellow citizens, not just immigrants. And so we now have to look at how we were able to make that progress and what the horizontal integration means, because sector by sector, the right wing is too strong. They can stymie us, they can pick us off, but horizontally integrated, joining legal suits together, mass mobilizations together, electoral processes of electing progressives. And I'm talking about progressives who might use the Democratic Party as their rubric, but I'm not talking about institutionalizing, pushing for the Democratic Party. But the masses of liberals and progressives are aligned around the Democratic Party. So we need to be there where they are to engage in this process of fighting fascism and in the process, kicking out these people who are conciliating in the leadership of the Democratic Party, where they find intersection with the Republican Party. And they're not the two same parties. That's not what I'm arguing. But it is not an either-or situation that we're facing now. Unite all who can be united.
We're almost out of time, but I think one of the best ways to end this conversation is to lean a little bit on what you said in passing with regards to Gaza, which is that if the massacre that is taking place in Gaza were to end tomorrow, full stop, it would still lead us to this very foundational issues of settler colonialism that brought us to this catastrophe that we see now in the first place. And I think with that in mind, to a certain degree, I think we should apply that to the future of history here, which is sort of the running thing of this conversation. The preservation of history and the preservation of these institutes like the Smithsonian Institutes, because the past informs the present here. And so if this assault on history and museums and all these educational institutions were to end tomorrow, it would still lead us to the point now where, look, we have to do more, if anything, double down on what has been done, you know, before, and expand upon it to preserve history, because it's quite clear that if it were to end tomorrow, this party, this Republican Party, will try to do it again. But again, we can only deal with the present right now. And so I guess my last question here is, how do we expand on that? How do we expand on, you know, raising more awareness to the preservation of history here during this important time? Because again, it's a lofty question, but much like the last question, it's given with a sense of urgency here.
So I speak from the vantage point of someone who is now 78 years old. And I speak from the vantage point, and I'll use the Smithsonian Institution as an example, as I engage many of the young adults who are there now in leadership, curatorial positions and whatnot. 99% of them do not know what went on before they arrived. They don't know the Latinos. They don't know the African-Americans. They don't know the gay men and lesbian women. They don't know the progressive white American curators and educators and other kinds of administrators who were just there 30 years ago, 25 years ago, who helped to open up a space, because they've gone to institutions that educate them, that socialize them as individuals, to achieve as individuals in the name of your gender group or your racial group or your ethnic group or what have you. They need to understand the struggles that went on before, the ground that they stand on, so that they can better figure out not just what they can do individually to advance their careers, but what they can do as social individuals. And that's one of the problems that we have. And so there's a lot of fear because they don't have the strength of history. They think they're there just because they are meritorious and individually smart. But it is looking at the history of these institutions and understanding what their mandates are and how people like ourselves, who think like us, who look like us, arrive. That is a critical thing to do. Otherwise, the Democratic Party leadership will rush in and say, let's go back to the pre-Trump era when America was, quote unquote, so great. It was not so great. They slow dragged. Just remember that it is Biden who brought us Clarence Thomas. It was Biden who would not listen to a Black woman who was talking about the assault on her as a woman. We want to whitewash that or blackwash that or whatever and forget it. So that's what I would say to this generation of people who are in working positions, who are in leadership positions. Understand what ground was turned and who turned it so that you could arrive. It will better help you understand not only what your individual professional pursuit will be, but your social responsibility for advancing democracy, not only for your group, but for all groups. And so horizontal integration into a mass resistance movement, thinking not just resistance, because resistance is to push back and stand in place. And we must resist because they're not just coming for us. They have already taken Latino immigrants. They've already put people into gulags and concentration camps.
I will say this, that as a son of Salvadoran immigrants, these are very dark times that we're seeing right now, both in the U.S. and in El Salvador. And we don't have to wait 30, 20, 10 years from now to recognize that history will not look kindly at this moment in time in the United States. And I will make it my life's duty to make sure that that happens, that people remember this moment in time. And hopefully it will be preserved in histories, in museums, in libraries, the way it should. And so with that said, we've been speaking with James Early, who's the former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. It's been a while since we last had you on the show, but it's been insightful. It's been enlightening. Thank you very much for being on the show with us, James Early.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Pacifica Radio. I'm Scott Baba. Russian President Vladimir Putin met U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff in Moscow today for renewed talks aimed at ending the war in Ukraine, even as a Russian general was killed in a car bombing and strikes on Kyiv killed at least 12 people. The high-stakes meeting marks Witkoff's fourth visit since the Trump administration began its push for a peace deal. President Trump has claimed progress, though U.S. officials suggest the plan could involve recognizing Russian control over seized Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has rejected ceding land. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said both sides have been shown a path to peace, but warned talks may collapse if progress stalls. Meanwhile, Russia intensified its aerial assault during a U.S.-brokered ceasefire period. Indian officials say that Indian and Pakistani soldiers briefly exchanged fire along their highly militarized frontier in Kashmir. The exchange comes as tensions soar between the nuclear-armed rivals following a deadly attack on tourists earlier this week. India has described the massacre in which gunmen killed 26 people, most of them Indian, as a terror attack, and blamed the Pakistan-linked resistance front for the assault, which was the region's worst in 25 years. Pakistan denied any connection to the attack. It was claimed by a previously unknown militant group calling itself the Kashmir Resistance. With the region on edge, three Indian army officials said that Pakistani soldiers fired at an Indian position in Kashmir late Thursday. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity in keeping with departmental policy. They said Indian soldiers retaliated. Heads of state and royalty will begin converging on Rome for Pope Francis's funeral in the Vatican's St. Peter's Square. But the group of poor people who will meet his casket in a small crosstown basilica are more in keeping with Francis's humble persona and disdain for pomp. U.S. President Donald Trump and Argentinian President Javier Milei are among the leaders arriving today. That's the last day the Argentine Pope will lie in state in St. Peter's Basilica before his coffin is sealed in preparation for his funeral. More than 128,000 mourners have waited in line to bid farewell to Francis. John Beaver reports.
We're approaching the final few hours of people being able to pay tribute to Pope Francis in person. He will lie in state until 7 o'clock tonight, local time, in St. Peter's Basilica. An hour after that, his coffin will be sealed ahead of the funeral tomorrow. The Vatican has said they expect 50 heads of state and 10 reigning monarchs to be among the guests at the funeral. Estimates vary wildly about the number of members of the public who are likely to attend, but some saying it could be as many as 250,000. Security here is being stepped up ahead of tomorrow. There's a huge number of police on the streets. There are even snipers on rooftops and police helicopters often flying overhead as the eyes of the world focus on the Vatican. John Beaver, Rome.
President Donald Trump ordered the Justice Department to investigate Act Blue, a major fundraising platform for Democrats over allegations of illegal donations. In a memorandum signed before departing for a high-dollar fundraiser, Trump cited concerns over straw donations and possible foreign contributions, directing Attorney General Pam Bondi to, quote, investigate allegations regarding the unlawful use of online fundraising platforms to make straw or dummy contributions or foreign contributions to political candidates and committees, and to take all appropriate actions to enforce the law. The directive references a recent GOP-led report accusing Act Blue of failing to prevent fraudulent contributions. Act Blue and House Democrats have dismissed the report as politically motivated. The move comes as